morning, everyone. I greet you in the name of Jesus this morning. You can turn in your Bibles to Matthew chapter 25. Continue our study here. We have three sections in this chapter. It's kind of a long chapter, but each section is kind of its own little sermon in a way. But we're going to try to cover it all this morning. But I think because the sections are so different, or at least they're not 100% related, I think we'll take it section by section this morning. And so right now we're going to read Matthew chapter 25, verses 1 through 13. Matthew 25, verse 1, "Then shall the kingdom of heaven be likened unto 10 virgins, which took their lamps and went forth to meet the bridegroom. And 5 of them were wise, 5 were foolish. They that were foolish took their lamps and took no oil with them. But the wise took oil in their vessels with their lamps. While the bridegroom tarried, they all slumbered and slept. And at midnight there was a cry made, Behold, the bridegroom cometh, go you out to meet him. Then all those virgins arose and trimmed their lamps, and the foolish said unto the wise, Give us of your oil, for our lamps are gone out. But the wise answered, saying, Not so, lest there be not enough for us and you, but go ye rather to them that sell and buy for yourselves. And while they went to buy, the bridegroom came, and they that were ready went with him to the marriage, and the door was shut. Afterward came also the other virgins, saying, Lord, Lord, open to us. But he answered and said, Verily I say unto you, I know you not. Watch therefore, for ye know neither the day nor the hour wherein the Son of Man cometh. One of the things I want to point out about this passage is that it comes right after Matthew 24. You say, well, that's obvious, right? Matthew 25 comes after Matthew 24. But if you will, go back with me to Matthew 24 just for a few brief points. If you look in verse 36, you will see Jesus says, Of that day and hour knoweth no man. Turn over to Matthew 25, verse 13, and you see the same thing. Ye know neither the day nor the hour. Flip back to Matthew chapter 24, and you see, as the days of Noah, you see that the people in verse 38 were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage. I find it interesting that the very next parable talks about a marriage. But what I want to show you here is in verse 5 of Matthew 25, the bridegroom tarries, they all slumber and sleep. My point being that there is fairly normal life going on. Go back to Matthew 24 and you look at verse 40 and 41, and you see two people in a field, one taken, the other left. Verse 41, two women grinding at the mill, one taken, the other left. Go to Matthew chapter 25, you will see 5 ready, 5 not ready. The parallels to me are interesting. And the point of going back and forth between those two is because I believe that Jesus is just continuing to tell the story of readiness and being prepared for the end. What end? Well, the end of time, we know it for sure. There's a bunch of questions here. We're looking at a parable. We know that parables are stories, natural things that teach us about spiritual things. And one of the things that we like to do with parables is we like to divide them out and decide, what does this mean? What does that mean? Who are these 10 virgins? Who's the bridegroom? What's the wedding? What's the oil? What are the vessels? What does all this symbolize? And we could go into that a little bit. One of the things that just kind of stumps me a little bit here is we have 10 virgins and one bridegroom. And as I began to study this, I began to wonder, is this man marrying 10 women? Are these bridesmaids? If that's the case, where's the bride? Should be 11 people here. And so when I got to these, who are these 10 virgins, I kind of hit a brick wall. I'm not exactly sure. And it made me wonder if maybe the whole point of this parable isn't so much about who these people are as much as it is being ready for the bridegroom. It's pretty obvious that the bridegroom is Jesus. I don't have any trouble seeing that connection. But there is, it appears to be that there is no one bride here. And so these answers, I feel like, can't be answered, or the questions can't be answered. I don't know that we can answer who the bride is and who these 10 virgins are. Because when you study the whole custom of these Eastern marriages and the way they would go out and meet them and then come back to the, there was always still just one bride there. I'm not really in favor of the interpretation that 10 brides. The only thing that I could think of in a relation to this that that might make sense is that when Jesus does come for his church, his bride, if you will, it isn't one person. It is a whole group of people. And so I'm going to kind of just go with that. Now, what about these vessels and their lamps? What's the point of all this? Well, we've heard different things, you know, the oil is the Holy Spirit, and or it's our Christianity, our spirituality, it's all. And again, you kind of come up short on this whole thing because, excuse me, you have this thought that the foolish people are asking the wise ones for their oil, and the wise don't say that it's impossible to give it. They just said, we don't want to because we're not sure if we have enough. So I'm not sure what to do with all of that either, because if it's the Holy Spirit, then there's no way, you can't ask for that from somebody else. So some of these questions, like who are these people and what all does it represent, I'm going to kind of just treat as not important. Is that okay? Because there's a real lesson here that we really need to get. And that's what I want to talk about next. We could debate a lot of things in here, but one thing that we cannot debate is that there is a lesson about being ready for Jesus' return, because it comes on the heels of Matthew 24. Jesus, our Bible is split up into chapters. Jesus didn't tell us, now we're starting a new chapter. He just was talking. And if your Bible has red letters, all of Matthew, almost all of Matthew 24 and all of Matthew 25 is red. So Jesus is just preaching. He's telling his disciples a whole bunch of things that he wants them to know. And this story is just simply to tell them that there are going to be people that are ready to meet Jesus when he comes back, and there's going to be people who are not ready to meet Jesus when he comes back. And that's the core of the whole parable that I want to get to. I don't really care so much about where all of these things fit and what modern day equivalent we would use. I'm not exactly sure that we can do that. And so the thing that we want to get at, I want to look at, I think I have five things that we want to see here, things that we can learn out of this passage about being ready. First of all, being ready is equal to wisdom. Notice that it is the wise virgins that are prepared. Wise people will prepare for Jesus' return. Foolish people don't. Foolish people say, where is the promise of his coming? Foolish people say, things have gone on this long. Jesus will never come back. Wise people say, yes, but God promised that Jesus will come back, and we are going to be ready. It doesn't matter how many centuries will pass. It could be that in 100 years there will be another generation, a complete set of new people in this building, talking about the very same parable. But that does not mean that Jesus isn't coming back. It just means that the danger of slumbering and sleeping gets more and more and more real. That's what it means. It doesn't mean that Jesus isn't coming back. So number one, being ready is equal to being wise. Number two, the thing that we want to learn here, is that the readiness or the lack of readiness only shows up when it's too late. See, these 10 virgins, I dare say, had an awful lot in common. They all went out together to meet the bridegroom. The only obvious difference on the way out was that some had oil and some didn't. You'll notice in verse 5 that they all slumbered and slept. Every single one of them fell prey to the desire to sleep. They all heard the cry. They all got up and trimmed their lamps. And suddenly, the difference between the 5 wise and the 5 foolish became obvious. 5 of them had no lamps that were burning or could even be burnt. There was nothing there to light. But it was too late. There wasn't enough time to run down to the market and get more oil and come back. And the same thing is going to be true for us. When Jesus returns, the time to get ready is now, not then. I do not believe that we will suddenly be able to get our lives in order just in time for Jesus to accept us. It's a very dangerous gamble to believe that somehow we're going to just quick get ready. This parable teaches us that the likelihood of that happening is very, very slim. So number two is that readiness, or the lack thereof, shows up only when it's too late. The third thing that we can learn from this parable about being ready is that readiness is a state of being. It is not something you can give to somebody. And that is one thing I want to learn that we can learn from this oil here. Whatever the oil represents, the wise could not, without going out, as it were, without their lamps going out, they could not give of their oil to another person. And so when the day comes that Jesus returns, and we go back to this terrible scene in Matthew 24 where there's actually a number of you sitting here on the bench, and half of you are ready and half of you are not ready. There is no way that those of you who are ready can pass off some readiness to the other people. And I don't know how that's going to feel. I don't even know what it's going to look like. I don't know what is going to happen when Jesus returns. There's differences of ideas on that. But this whole thing of half, the other thing that I want to point out here is that it's interesting that the ratio is always half. It's always 50%. 2 in the field, 1's taken, the other one left. 5 are foolish, 5 are wise. It's always 50%. Does that actually mean that 50% of us here this morning will not be ready when Jesus returns? That's the numbers that are biblical. I'm not saying that's the way it is. I just want you to think about this little story that I'm about to tell you. Is the old John Risser, the bishop in the Southeastern Conference, gave a talk before he died. I forget what it was, but it was kind of a reminiscence of his life as a bishop. He was a bishop for a long time. And he said in that talk that if he looked at his records and did his figuring correctly, 50% of the people that he baptized are in the world. And he was he didn't really talk about it in a way that was, I'm sure it made him sad, but it wasn't like, he's like, well, what else do you expect? That's what you see. And so, a little exercise for you. Take your baptismal class, the people that you were baptized with. How many of them are professing anything to do with Christianity, and how many of them are not? Just just for a little exercise. Is it 50%? Or is it? And if there was a way that we could that we could give some of our readiness to those people, would we do it? But the fact is we can't. And I'm not saying that to sound scary or to even sound downhearted. It's just a fact that we need to deal with, that any of us at any time could be caught in a state of being not ready. That we could foolishly believe that at the last minute somehow we'll just get ready. But we can never borrow our state of readiness from somebody else. The fourth thing that I want us to learn here is that being ready for Jesus' return requires forethought. This is not a new concept. In our journey through Matthew, there are different times that Jesus tells us about a cost that we're going to pay. He tells us that we should be careful that we don't lay a foundation and then we don't build. He tells us that we shouldn't be like the man going out to war without thinking through the implications of it all. And so whenever we come to this point that we want to give our lives to Christ and we want to follow him, one of the things that we should be asking people and asking ourselves is, are we willing to do whatever it takes to get all the way through? Are you actually ready to lug all that oil along? Are you actually willing to spend the money that it takes to build the castle or the tower? Forethought in the journey of following Christ to be ready when he returns is, we need to think through that. And the other thing that I want us to learn here is that I think that sometimes we actually have to recommit to that whole thing. Because when you're 15 and you come to Christ, or however old you are, for the foreseeable future, you say, yes, I want to go all the way. I want to be ready. But then when you're 20, and then when you're 25, and then when you're 50, and then when you're 75, there's going to be tests that come, and there's going to be things that come along, and we're going to wonder, am I really committed to going all the way through, or am I going to take an easier way out? And we need to recommit and stay ready. Readiness doesn't happen once and done. We need to continue to count that cost and continue to make the decision that, yes, I'm going to spend whatever it takes to put one more brick onto that tower, or whatever it is. I'm just using that as an illustration. The fifth thing that I want to take from this parable is that being ready can appear to be a distraction. In life, so many things look urgent and important. We've got to get life taken care of. We've got to keep food on the table for us men. For the ladies, you have to keep making the food. You have to keep the children in clothes. You have to do your responsibilities at church. You have to meet your neighbors. There's just 1,001 things that weigh in on a person. And those things look important. In this case, they slumbered and slept. Back in Matthew 24, they were eating and drinking. They were living normal lives. They were just doing what it took to stay alive. And they were living life. But living life often interferes with being ready. Readiness can look like something that we will take care of later when we have time. And the urgent things of life overcome the important things of life. It's important that we are ready. It's probably urgent too, but it doesn't feel that way very often. So let's just remember that normal life is going to very likely interfere with our state of readiness. We need to decide what we're going to sacrifice. Are we going to sacrifice our readiness to meet the bridegroom, or are we going to sacrifice some of the things that look like it's more important? A lot of things that we can learn there. Those are the ones that I want us to take away from here. Let's move on to verses 14 through 30, looking at the next parable. Verse 14, Matthew 25. For the kingdom of heaven is as a man traveling into a far country, who called his own servants and delivered unto them his goods. And unto one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1, to every man according to his several ability. And straightway he took his journey. Then he that had received the 5 talents went and traded with the same, and made them other 5 talents. And likewise he that received 2, he also gained other 2. But he that had received 1 went and digged in the earth and hid his Lord's money. After a long time, the Lord of those servants cometh and reckoneth with them. And so he that had received 5 talents came and brought other 5 talents, saying, Lord, thou deliverest unto me 5 talents. Behold, I have gained beside them 5 talents more. His Lord said unto him, Well done, thou good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will make thee ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord. He also that had received 2 talents came and said, Lord, thou deliverest unto me 2 talents. Behold, I have gained 2 other talents beside them. His Lord said unto him, Well done, good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will make thee ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord. Then he which had received the 1 talent came and said, Lord, I knew thee, that thou art an hard man, reaping where thou hast not sown, and gathering where thou hast not strawed. And I was afraid, and I went and hid thy talent in the earth. Lo, there thou hast that is thine. His Lord answered and said unto him, Thou wicked and slothful servant, thou knewest that I reap where I sowed not, and gather where I have not strawed. Thou oughtest therefore to have put my money to the exchangers, and then at my coming I should have received mine own with usury. Take therefore the talent from him, and give it unto him that hath 10 talents. For unto every one that hath shall be given, and he shall have abundance. But from him that hath not shall be taken away even that which he hath. And cast ye the unprofitable servant into outer darkness, and there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So here we have, also in the context of the end of time as we know it, when Jesus returns, the scene of the steward of this man and his 3 servants or stewards, where he divided up his goods, took a journey. And there's a couple of things here that I don't understand. I don't quite understand if the servants knew that they were supposed to do something with it, or what exactly was going on. It just says that he called them together and he gave them out whatever he thought they could handle. And these servants went and did certain things with their talents. So I don't know if they knew that they were supposed to do something with it or not. It seems like they obviously knew that they were expected to do something. They were expected not to lose it, for sure, because the lazy servant, he seemed to be glad to be able to give the 1 talent back. But there's also this thought here that comes through in verse 27 that seems to indicate that the servants should have known that they were to do something with it. So I don't want to get hung up in these little things, but it is interesting that there's no instructions. He just gives them the money. What is the money? Well, in this passage, the money is in talents. According to one writer, it's a talent was worth about $1,200, perhaps more. One of the things that you'll notice in this passage is that the talents are distributed based on ability. And so if we were to interpret this parable, if we were to look at this and try to figure out what is for us today, or what spiritual lesson here, obviously the man going into a far country is likely referring to Jesus Christ, and he's giving his servants his goods. What all that is, now obviously Jesus didn't leave us with money, but he did leave us with the responsibility to build the kingdom as his followers. And so the first thing that you'll notice here in this parable is that each person gets according to his ability. God will never give you more than what you're able to handle. Ever. And we're talking in the spiritual sense here, as far as spiritual responsibility and the responsibility in the kingdom. They were also judged on ability. The man with two talents was judged just as well, or he was given the same reward as the one with five. Notice the words to the servants. I want to point that out too in verses 21 and 23. The servants are called good and faithful. I think there's a lesson for us there in the whole thing of faithfulness. I don't know what word you would like God to give you at the judgment day, but I'm pretty sure I'd be happy if God would give me that badge that he considered me to be faithful. That word has a lot of good things there. The other person, though, is called wicked and slothful, or wicked and lazy. So what all can we learn from this passage? Again, I'm not really going to go into what all the talents might represent. I do not believe that this is a parable that gives some people I didn't say that right. This parable is not only speaking about financial, physical money. It's possible that it is speaking about that in some sense, but this parable is definitely about the kingdom of heaven. It is not about the kingdom of the earth, and I think that money is largely part of the kingdom of the earth. Nor are we left with a huge treasury that somehow Jesus is expecting us to handle. So it's literally not money. It's a lesson that we're trying to learn. So what all does this mean? Well, the lessons that I want to get from this, maybe we should just leave that for what it is and go on with this. The first thing I want us to learn is that God expects faithfulness in whatever we do and whatever we have. It doesn't matter if we're talking about money. It doesn't matter if we're talking about intrinsic talent, like are you able to make something really well? Some people have talents of different things. Now I'm moving into the word talent as in abilities to do things. But God expects us to be faithful in everything that he gives us. What is faithfulness? Well, I believe that faithfulness is doing with the things that we have, the things that we are given. We're doing with that whatever gives God glory and builds his kingdom. And so you can look at your money, you can look at your native abilities, you can look at whatever it is that you have, your physical body. Are you being faithful with the things that God has given you? And one of the ditches that we get into is that somehow we think that the less we have, the less faithful we need to be. I think that was part of the problem with this man with one talent. I think he looked at the other men and he said, well, I don't have five, I don't have two. So if I just preserve this one, then somehow I'm going to be okay. And we can do the same thing. We can look at ourselves and we can say, well, God hasn't given me near as much as he's given brother so-and-so. And so therefore, I'm not as responsible. And that's actually false. If this man would have gone out with his one talent and done whatever he could with it, even if all it was to try to gain a little bit of interest, I believe the story would have been different. So again, the lesson that we need to get from this is it does not matter what you have, you're expected to be faithful. I'm expected to be faithful, no matter how little it might be. And by the way, if we're not faithful in little things, Jesus told us somewhere else in Luke, I believe it is, if we're not faithful in little things, nobody will trust us with big things. You can't take care of a rabbit, you'll never take care of a horse. It's just the way it is. Lesson number two. I've been kind of saying this, but I'm going to state it directly, and that is that we will be held accountable for our faithfulness or our lack thereof. Here again, one of the things that connects this parable to the parable we looked at before is that there's a personal responsibility here. The man with the two talents did not have to answer for the man with five or one. And that's exactly the same thing true for us as well. If we look at what God has blessed us with, whatever it is, whatever the talents, native abilities, money, responsibilities, all the things that you know God has given you to take care of. Remember that you will answer for what you do with your stuff, the things that God has given you. You will not have to answer for what I do with mine. And I will not have to answer for what you do with yours. That doesn't mean that we don't care about each other. I just thought about how that might sound. But sometimes we get this idea that because so-and-so is slacking off over here, that I get to slack off. Could the man with the two talents look at the man with the one talent and say, well, why am I working so hard? I think he could have. I think he could have looked at that and said, well, I'm gonna take it easy. I'm done. I'm just not gonna work anymore. But he understood that he was gonna have to answer for his work, not for the other man's work. So that's lesson number two, that we will each be held accountable for our faithfulness or the lack thereof. Third thing that we need to look at here in this passage of the talents is that excuses are not helpful and they are not a means of escape in judgment. There's something really sobering about human nature, and I find this in my own life. When I do something that is wrong, and I know that God probably isn't very pleased about it, if I can somehow justify why I did it in my own mind, I think that God's going to be okay with it. Have you ever faced anything like that? I'm embarrassed to admit that I think that way sometimes. And this is exactly what this man did. I think he sat there with his talent, and he looked at his talent, and he said, my master is an exacting man, and I don't know if I can do anything with this talent that's going to please him. And I know I can't do with what these other, I know I can't double it like these other guys are doing. And so I'm going to think through this and come up with a reason that when I face my master, I'm going to tell him this is why I did what I did. And it sounds so logical and it sounds so good to us. But when the master comes, he just strips it away and he says, you know what? That's true. You're exactly right. I am a hard man. I do reap where I haven't strawed and so on, or where I haven't sowed. But that doesn't mean you couldn't have done anything with it. And I think the same thing is going to be true for us. when we are in a situation where we are trying to justify ourselves, it may sound so good to us, and we might even convince everybody else in this room that what we did was legitimate and we had excuses for it. But when we stand before God, the judge of all the earth, he will do right, and we will not be able to escape judgment. Let's go to number four, fourth thing that we should learn here. If we feel or believe that we have only one talent, we can join it with others to make gain for God's kingdom. I get that from what the master told this servant. He says, you could have at least put it in the bank and gained a little interest. You could have done that. And so let's just think, for instance, that maybe we feel that our gifts, our abilities, the things God has given us, aren't really going to make that much difference. We don't have five talents. We don't have two talents. All we have is one. What if this man with one talent would have gone to the man with five and said, can you help me with one talent? I don't really know how to do what you're doing. I don't know how to double my money. But could you help me? Because when the master comes, I want to at least say that I tried, right? And so whenever we are down to where we feel like we only have one talent that God has given us, I think God will be okay with us taking it and saying, I don't really know what to do with it, but I want help to know what to do with it. And it will gain a little bit of interest because we've pooled assets with another person. I don't want to take that too far because I just told us that we will be accountable for our own thing. But again, think through with me. What did the master mean if he didn't mean that? I think he would have been okay with it. He would have been okay with the fact that he joined up with somebody else to try to make a little bit off of what he was given. Obviously, the last thing that we learn from here is that faithfulness is rewarded. We get that from verses 29 and 30. Faithfulness is rewarded. Laziness, slothfulness is not. And we know where we want to be in that situation. Well, moving on, let's look now at the very last part of this chapter. Verses 31 to 46. When the Son of Man shall come in his glory and all the holy angels with him, then shall he sit upon the throne of his glory. And before him shall be gathered all nations, and he shall separate them one from another, as a shepherd divideth his sheep from the goats. And he shall set the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on the left. Then shall the king say unto them on his right hand, come, ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was an hungered, and ye gave me meat. I was thirsty, and ye gave me drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me in. Naked, and ye clothed me. I was sick, and ye visited me. I was in prison, and ye came unto me. Then shall the righteous answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee an hungered, and fed thee, or thirsty, and gave thee drink? When saw we thee a stranger, and took thee in, or naked, and clothed thee? Or when saw we thee sick, or in prison, and came unto thee? And the king shall answer and say unto them, verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these my brethren, ye have done it unto me. Then shall he say unto them on the left hand, depart from me, ye cursed, into everlasting fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was an hungered, and ye gave me no meat. I was thirsty, and ye gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me not in. Naked, and ye clothed me not. Sick, and in prison, and ye visited me not. Then shall they also answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee an hungered, or a thirst, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and did not minister unto thee? Then shall he answer them, saying, verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye did it not to one of the least of these, ye did it not to me. And these shall go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into life eternal. This is not so much a parable. It's sort of parable because it talks about sheep and goats. It's kind of a illustration there. But it seems to be more of an actual foretelling of how the final judgment will look. That there will be people gathered together, and there will be a separating, setting some to the left, some to the right, and Jesus, the King, will bless the ones on the right and the ones on the left. And the basis of this judgment appears to be the way we treated people that God brought into our lives. He says that to the people on the right, he says, you gave me food, you gave me drink, you took me in, you gave me clothes, you visited me. And then he says, you've done it to the least of these, my brethren. And the judgment was the same for the ones on the left. It's really sobering to think about that, because there are really so many things, so many people that God brings into our lives, and we are unsure how to help them. In fact, we can think of really good reasons not to help them. And we can think of good reasons that they would abuse our help. And we're actually probably right. But I would take you back to the excuses of the slothful servant and remind us that excuses and judgment aren't very helpful. I don't know that I have a whole lot of lessons that we can learn out of this. I just want to point a couple of things out. First of all, I would dare say that the people that were judged, the goats on the left, seem not to actively ignore or to turn away from needs. It seems that they just didn't care. They just had their own lives to live. They did not actively seek to help people. And I think that if we would get more active, if I would get more active in ministering to people, that perhaps it would shift my focus to the important things and not so much to the urgent things. And maybe that would help in the whole thing of being ready when Jesus comes. Maybe it would help to take our one talent and turn it into two. That maybe if we could get a grip on what Jesus sees as important and begin to work in that in our own lives, that some of these other problems that we talked about would take care of themselves. I wonder if that's not true. See, when it comes to our Christian lives and true Christianity, what does Menno Simons call it? True evangelical faith. It's this list right here, isn't it? And it seems to me that this is the stuff that God makes a big deal out of. And we need to make a big deal out of it too. One of the flaws of humanity is to really make a big deal out of the things that God does not make a big deal out of. And we make a way too little of a deal out of the things that God makes a big deal out of. I hope you can forgive me for using, it almost sounds slang to say it that way, but this is a big deal to God. He really actually will judge people based on the way they treated sick and hungry. And really? I thought he cared about being good stewards. I thought he cared about having our clothes just right. Or maybe even having our doctrine just down to where it's bulletproof. Actually, it doesn't seem to be that way. Verse 46 ends up with two options: everlasting punishment or life eternal. And that's really the two options that follow this whole chapter. We see it in the story of the 10 virgins, we see it in the story of the loan money, and we see it in the scene of the final judgment. You know, the gospel and the what we heard about in devotions this morning, whenever when we read the Bible, it puts life into a proper perspective. Everything falls in place. And so when we look at this, it's really not that complicated. It's really not that hard. Let's not make it hard. Well, to conclude this, I don't know how to conclude a sermon like this. Study these verses, and I would be open to anything that you feel that I stated. If it was wrong, I would like to know where I'm wrong. But one of the things that intrigues me is that Jesus ends his teaching. If you take a look at Matthew 26, now we're just going into our next lesson, but Matthew 26, 27, and 28, there are very few red letters in my Bible. And my point is that before Jesus goes into trial, and before he goes into his death and burial and resurrection, it seems like he's hitting some of the most important things to him. And if you look back through Matthew 23, his address to the religious leaders, that's what Matthew 23 was. And from there we move into Matthew 24, which is the being ready for Jesus' return. Matthew 25 also is readiness for his return. Ends up with this scene of judgment. It just feels to me like a man who knows that his time is running out and that he is going to say everything that he needs to say. And then he goes to face the final few hours of his life. And it seems like he can go there because he's given everything that he needs to give. I'm just thinking through how this must have felt for Jesus to know that he has only so much time left. And that's what we'll look at next time.